Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all here with us today. We are about to have a conversation with Michael Moss. He's been with us before, joined us again especially to join us during this fun drive here on WEA. So while we talk to Michael, we encourage you to call 410-319-8888 to get a copy of his book for a pledge of $100. But we're going to jump into our conversation to start with. Well, also one thing on the way there, Aaron Green, the last hour, got us over the top and made his pledge. Thank you, Aaron Green, for being part here of the WEAA. We appreciate it. And Michael Moss, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, his book, we're talking about Salt, Sugar, Fat. Welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Hey, nice to talk to you again.
And appreciate you doing this, doing our fun drive. It means a great deal to us.
You know, I have something to say about that, actually.
All right.
So, you know, I work for the New York Times, which basically means we have to forego many of our citizenship, you know, responsibilities. We can't campaign for politicians or give them money or, frankly, sort of join any causes that might be seen at all as controversial and or indicative that we're choosing sides. But there is one thing that we're allowed to do, and that's donate money to our local public radio stations. And when I fail to do so, I guarantee you that my wife Eve will be on my case, reminding me to give generously. So what could I say?
Well, we appreciate it, Michael, a lot. And you have a Baltimore connection, so this is also good. So,
yes, Herman, the three-quarter astronomer. If it's nice and sunny down there, you can bet he's going to be out on the streets tonight.
My old friend.
We should patch him in, get an update.
We should. Maybe I'll give my producers his number. We'll call him up and see what's going on.
That'd be great.
So, this book. When we did it last, I mean, it's an incredible piece of work. But what I want to start with, just give our listeners who didn't hear our previous conversation before we hit each piece of this salt, sugar, and fat, is to talk about how you found out what you found out, how you found these documents that kind of unraveled and revealed a world to you that you almost didn't expect, that led you on this journey to find out why salt, sugar, fat so deep into our diets.
Absolutely. And for me, you know, Mark, this was like being inside a detective story because so much of it was really surprising to me. I had one incredible stroke of luck, which is that when the state's attorney general sued big tobacco back in the 90s. They settled, and part of that settlement was the requirement that tobacco companies give up millions of pages of their documents, which are being archived and now are publicly available. Reporters have sort of lost interest. Nobody even looks at them anymore. But I discovered that within that trove of tobacco documents are these memos and letters and strategy papers and meeting minutes where the largest tobacco company of all, Philip Morris, was talking to its food division managers, the people at General Foods and Kraft, because what some of us have forgotten is that Philip Morris became the largest food manufacturer in North America starting back in the 80s when it acquired General Foods and Kraft. And so suddenly I was at the table of these and other of the largest food giants as they're formulating and planning and plotting their way to creating and marketing and selling new products. And it's that enabled me to identify and then talk their key people into talking to me and revealing even more secrets.
And it was interesting because the conversations you had with them were revealing in some of the things they did you could feel and see were kind of nefarious and underhanded. On the other hand, you had people in that food industry who wanted to try to do the right thing and were really open about what they were doing, and others, especially scientists, who didn't really see what they were doing to kind of addict us to these ingredients, didn't really see or feel they're doing anything wrong. They were being scientists.
Yeah, and you know, I was really struck by how many of them have had some regret about their life work. But one of their defenses is, look, say some of these products we invented back in a more innocent era in the 70s, 80s when our dependence on these products wasn't what it is today. And they make a valid point there, but you make a bigger point that within all of these companies, there are cabals of insiders who have been fighting to do the right thing by consumer health, by and large, unsuccessfully. But these are people who really, truly care.
So as we kind of delve into this deeper, one of the things I think you talked about the Philip Morris and the food industry and how these scientists who kind of developed all this very, very early and something almost stumbling onto it. Like even we'll talk a bit later about cheese, but you know, cheese has become a huge part of our diet. But it started fairly humbly, didn't it?
Cheese, rather, or the, sort of the whole thing. Well,
the whole thing, really.
If you know, the whole thing started way back with Dr. Kellogg. You can really see the turn of the century. He had a sanitarium out in Battle Creek, Michigan, where he was bringing in people to sort of cure their dyspepsia and other health issues. He despised sugar and started creating and invented a breakfast cereal for people that had, like, zero sugar in it. As you can imagine, it sold kind of okay with his people. Until younger brother Will came along and took over the cereal business, snuck in sugar when his older brother was on a business trip to Denver. And that was the beginning of the sweetened breakfast cereal. His own patients went nuts. The brothers fought, went to court. You can really sort of trace forward the origins of the processed food industry to that very day.
I mean, I guess one could make the argument, but before all this salt, sugar, fat cut in our diets, some people might argue our food was boring. Some might argue.
But the other thing to remember is that you know, it's not salt, sugar, and fat that are bad. It's these huge amounts that
are in
processed foods and the industry's own dependence on those. So by all means, salt, sugar, fat, you know, defines much of my own personal diet. But we're all about sort of now trying to gain control over those three and processed foods rather than let them control us. And quantity is a huge part of the deal.
We're going to have a brief break to come back and talk about WEAA and this book and how you can get this book and be part of this conversation here on The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly feature on the future of food in our food system. Stay with us. Don't go away. We'll be right back with Michael Moss. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We are here with Michael Moss. Michael Moss, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, works for the New York Times. This book is Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Michael Moss's books have just and work has just been amazing, and it's a pleasure to have him here on the air with us. So, Michael, let's jump right into some of the more recent stuff that we've been talking about. And I've been following your work also in the Times a lot. But let's talk about Hot Pockets for a minute, talking about salt.
You know, salt is, to the food industry, a miracle ingredient that does so many things for them. One, it acts as a preservative, right? So their products can last on the shelf for months at a time without deteriorating. Two, it's incredibly inexpensive at 10 cents a pound, and so it lets them avoid using fresh spices and herbs and can use salt instead for what the industry calls the flavor burst. Salt is usually the first thing that touches your saliva when you eat something, and that sense that interacts with your taste receptors and sends that signal to the pleasure center of the brain that says, love it, eat more. And what surprised me is the extent to which salt acts as a savior to the food industry to mask, cover up some of the off notes, the bad flavors that are inherent to some processed foods. One of the toughest problems for them is meat, because when you rewarm meat, like in a product, like a frozen meat sandwich, like the Hot Pocket or in canned soup, the fat in the meat oxidizes and gives off what the industry calls warmed over flavor. Their chemists describe it as the taste of wet dog hair. And you guessed it, the solution to wet dog hair taste, warmed over flavor in processed foods is to add a little bit more salt. And so you'll find products, whether they're meat-based or not, like the Hot Pocket, which for a single package will have the maximum amount of sodium recommended for a majority of adults in an entire day. The amounts of salt in products are actually staggering. And I realized at one point that their dependence on salt is actually far greater than ours because, you know, we're not born liking salt like we are sugar and fat. Liking for salt comes at about 6 months of age. And the Monell Center in Philadelphia, which in fact gets some of its money from the food industry, has done some research showing that the processed food industry is usually implicated in the development of cravings for salt. They looked at kids, divided them into half, and those who got regular sort of grocery store food starting at 6 months, which inherently is quite salty by and large, they were much more apt to be craving salt by the time they're in preschool, even licking the salt shaker. And the flip side of that, too, is that any of your listeners who are older, who's been under doctor's order to cut back on sodium, knows that after about 6 weeks of time avoiding salty foods, you can hardly go shopping in the grocery store anymore because so many things taste over salty because you have adjusted your liking for salt downward. Well, as much as we can do that, avoid a salt craving in the first place and then get rid of it, the food companies are incredibly hooked on it.
Now, you had a piece, a wonderful little video I saw in the New York Times about salt, but its combination with fat. Was it about Cheetos?
Yeah, we recently did one on the Doritos.
Right.
You know, Doritos and Cheetos, these are engineered to what the food industry views as just the height of perfection in processed foods. They have so many incredible sort of elements in them. One of the most fabulous ones to them is this thing called sensory-specific satiety, which I like to call forgettability. When they balance all of the ingredients in those chips perfectly, and you eat one, you're left with kind of this memory of having eaten a really good thing, but you're not left with a memory of any one of the elements, whether it's salt or sugar or fat or the MSG or what have you. And that avoids tripping this part of the brain that puts a brake on overeating. And basically, if we get too much of one flavor, our brain says to us, hey, had enough of that, let's move on to something else. And by perfectly harmonizing the ingredients in their products, they avoid doing that, and so we're much more apt to eat more and more of them.
Now, that part of it, reading that in the other parts of your book to describe that in various ways with various people in different industries, and I know as a reporter and a writer, you kind of bring us the entire story and show us the breadth and depth and contradictions of the human beings that are part of the process as well in all of us, which is what makes your work in the book so important and powerful. But as I read it, it did upset me.
Uh-oh.
You know?
Because I was talking about your favorite foods, Mark?
Yeah. Well, one of my producers just sent me a note saying...
Oh, wait. Because you were getting cravings, yeah. Like I was when I was writing the book.
But one of my producers just sent me a note saying, you love Cheetos, so...
Let me put on a Cheeto. I'll tell you about Cheetos. That's your favorite, right? So the Cheeto has this amazing thing that the industry calls the vanishing caloric density, right? When you take that little puffed thing and put it, you know, and press it between the tongue and the roof of your mouth, it kind of melts, right? And when it melts, that sends a signal to the brain that the calories have disappeared. And you, Mark, might as well be eating celery for all your brain cares about when you're eating those Cheetos because of the vanishing caloric density. It actually just it causes food scientists just to sort of laugh and chuckle out loud.
And the other part of that, though, is when you read, no matter which part of this book it is, and we'll talk about the other parts, sugar and fat, in a minute, but it's also you realize that something egregious is going on to the American public on some levels.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And this is a hugely serious thing. I mean, there was a meeting of, you know, in 1999, I write about it, was secret, it was private,
right.
CEOs from the largest food companies in North America. They got together, and one of their own, a senior executive at Kraft, stands up armed with 114 slides, and he lays at their feet, in large part, culpability for not only the obesity crisis, but diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. He even starts associating their products with several types of cancers. There's no question that we are in a huge health crisis now that can be blamed in part on processed on processed foods and their incredible drive to get us not just to like their products, but to want more and more of them.
But and that's the part, you know, when people seem, I mean, it can't be whitewashed in the sense that people know what they're doing. I mean, they were developing products that, as you write about, that target our taste buds, that create these kind of things like hang time flavor systems that make us kind of crave things more. This is a conscious effort, though, to make us buy the product.
You know, it is to maximize the allure, and I think it is important to say that I don't view this industry as this evil empire that intentionally
set out to
make us overweight. And they can argue that, look, no single one of their products can be blamed, for the obesity crisis. Rather, the problem lies in their collective zeal to do what companies do, which is to try to make as much money as possible by selling as much product as possible. And it lies in their own incredible dependence on salt, sugar, fat to make their products convenient, low cost, and utterly alluring. And it's a very fine line between making something that's attractive, like any cook would want to do, and making something that leads to what addiction scientists call sort of patterns of compulsive intake.
I mean, because you do talk to people. I was thinking about a passage I read in the book about somebody at Nestle's you were interviewing, and how he talked about how thin the people were in Switzerland because they exercise, and how he eats only vegetables and doesn't eat meat at night and gets his protein from fish and doesn't even probably use his own products.
Well, that struck me too, which is how many of the executives I spoke to do not eat their own products, especially when they run into health trouble themselves. I think there's a bit of an economic socio thing going on. They don't need to. They can afford, fresh fruits and vegetables, unlike many people. But also, I think they're just very aware of the magnetism, the allure that they've built into their products. It is, as one executive said, he would come home and eat a whole bag of potato chips with his martini after work. And when he blew out his knee and couldn't run anymore to burn some of those calories, he had to just go cold turkey and not eat any potato chips because he knew that he couldn't stop at just one little tiny serving.
We are here with Michael Moss. We're talking about his book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. We're going to take a brief break, talk about your favorite radio station, WEAA, and come back with Michael Moss. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we are here with Michael Moss talking about his book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, here on The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly program looking at the future of the food system and farming in America. 410, oh, no, we're not doing that now. We're having a conversation with Michael Moss. But you can call 410-319-8888, make your pledge while we talk to Michael Moss. So, Michael, sugar. There's a great quote in your book, a big piece in your book about only sugar can do it all.
Yes, and also that the companies have been exploiting the biology of the child through their engineering and sort of manipulation, if you will, of sweetness in foods. I was lucky to spend time with a legend in the industry named Howard Moskowitz. He was trained in high math at Queens College and then experimental psychology at Harvard. And he has created many of the biggest icons in the grocery store for the food industry. He walked me through his recent creation of a new soda flavor for Dr. Pepper, in which he started with no less than 61 different formulations of sweetness, each one just slightly different than the other, subjected those to 3,000-plus consumer taste testings around the country, then took the data, threw it in his computer, did his high math regression analysis thing, and out came a chart of what he has helped sort of coin the term the bliss point, which is basically the optimum amount of sweetness that would send most of us over the moon and the product flying off the shelf. And it looks like a bell-shaped curve, the kind of thing that kids would get, and they would dread sort of being at the top of the curve in the middle because that would be the middle C. But in this case, the top of the curve is the bliss point for sweetness, not too little and not too much sweetness. And what's really concerning to nutritionists and health policy people and public health agencies who are paying this $300 bill for obesity in North America is that companies have marched around the grocery store creating, engineering bliss points for foods that never really used to be sweet before. So that old bread now has sugar in it with an engineered bliss point. Low-fat yogurt can have as much sugar in it as ice cream. One of my favorites, prepared pasta sauces, some of the brands can have the equivalent of a couple of Oreo cookies in a tiny half-cup serving. And what this does, especially to kids who are so vulnerable to sugar, it teaches them to expect sweetness in everything they eat. So that when you drag the little rascals over to the produce aisle and get them to eat more vegetables, which everybody says we should be eating more of, you know, they're going to get hit by those bitter notes even harder than they otherwise would.
And it is shocking, because this is really shocking to some of us who read the book, to me anyway. We've always assumed this, but this was really, in terms of the research, directed at our children in a very real way.
And the marketing targeting children is so important to the food industry. I got to spend time with the former president of Coca-Cola for North America, Jeffrey Dunn. He was one of their fiercest warriors for 20 years before he left the company. He walked me through their describing of their best customers as calling them heavy users, people who drink three cans or even more of Coke a day. They're pioneering of the supersize me phenomena. But where Coke really distinguishes itself among other snack companies is the targeting of children in convenience stores, where the snack food companies know that when kids go in there with a little bit of spending money on their own and start making their decision about what to buy, they will be brand loyal from then on. And so the companies use what they call up and down the street marketing, which refers to their trucks driving up and down, going from corner store to corner store. And what's especially gripping is that those stores strategically encircle schools to get kids going into school and coming out of them.
And I was thinking about my own life growing up. You know, in our generation, you were either a Coca-Cola person, you were a Pepsi person, you were an RC person, and that had and for life.
And it turns out the whole soda wars that people love to sort of write about, the fight between Coke and Pepsi, wasn't what you thought it was. It wasn't two companies sort of, you know, extracting blood from each other. As one of the CEOs of the company said, if the other one hadn't existed, we would have invented them, because they found that every time Pepsi went after Coke or Coke went after Pepsi, we would drink more of either one. And that's what they were after, was share of stomach, right? The amount of soda that we collectively drank, and that would just go up and up and up.
And this whole kind of, look at things very carefully. This morning I came in for our morning drive time show to help them pitch, and I had my yogurt, which I thought was a really healthy thing to eat, my Chobani yogurt. And then one of my co-hosts that morning, Robert, was saying, "Read what's on the label. You're eating a sugar bowl." So
I don't know about Chobani, but some of the yogurts, you know, like I mentioned, can be incredibly loaded with sugar. And for years, the industry has used yogurt for its aura of health. The other thing you see around the grocery store on the front of the label is touting of the word fruit.
Yes.
And that could mean just a tiny little smidgen of fruit juice concentrate in the product, which is basically just another form of sugar, allows them to put the word fruit on the front. So I like to say that you actually, you know, it's actually very informative to start being careful as a consumer by reading the front of the package and not just the fine print. But, you know, speaking of that, I mean, I hope listeners are calling to buy the book, not just so, you know, so I, and I'll help me write the next book. But because it really is empowering. If you know anybody who's ever read a diet book, I actually think that this book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, you know, once you know what the food companies are doing to you, the second you walk into the grocery store to try to compel you to buy their product, I actually find that goes far toward leveling the playing field. And that as a diet aid, it can work incredibly well, just kind of knowing everything that they're up to and trying to convince you.
And before we go to break here to talk about WEA, I mean, I think that when we look at sugar, we're also not realizing that so much of this sugar is made up of high fructose corn syrup, which is the why we see all these cornfields around us growing mounds and mounds of corn, and how that concentrated sugar is very different and does different things to our body than, let's say, the sugar we might get from the fields.
So I'm actually convinced by people I think are pretty smart on this that when it comes to calories, there really isn't much different among sugars. So sugar from sugar beets or sugar cane, sugar from field corn, sugar from fruit is all pretty much going to hit your body in the same way in terms of calories. One exception may be the very pure form of fructose, which you do see in some products now, generally at pretty low levels, but there is some research pointing and raising some alarms about fructose. But generally, from just a pure calorie standpoint, the general sense out there among experts is that sugar is sugar is sugar, and the industry plays a game where they'll move from fruit to corn syrup to table sugar, depending on which one we're more concerned about at any point in time.
So we're here talking with Michael Moss about his incredible book. I really, really love this book. He's back on the air with us here for our fun drive. The book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. We will be back in just a minute with Michael Moss. Right now we're going to take a little break and talk about WEAA in your future. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I'm here with Michael Moss. We're talking about Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. He joins us once again for our fun drive, which is wonderful because people are buying his book at 410-319-8888, which is part of the purpose of this conversation here on the Mark Steiner Show and Sound Bites, our weekly look at farming and the future of our food system. So, Michael, I know we have this kind of quick abbreviated discussion today, but that's all right. Let's go to the question of fat. And where did all this, you know, when you read the labels, talk a bit about the history of that and where all this fat crept into the food we eat popularly every day.
Glad to, Mark. But, you know, first I got to pick myself off the floor. Because,
why?
You know, I'm in Brooklyn and we don't get offers like you're making. I'm just sort of astounded. I mean, dinner with a star radio host with produce from a star grower in your area. That's for what did you say the price was?
$200.
Oh my God, that is like, you know, it. Like I say, we don't. Your phones would be ringing off the hook here, because look, I mean, the reverse of that too. There is nobody to get serious here. There is nobody sort of more price sensitive than the processed food industry. When they see sales flag just by a little tiny fraction of a percentage, they go absolutely crazy. And more people are being convinced that as we are at this tipping point where we care more and more about what we put into our bodies, if that will translate into people making decisions in the grocery store about what to buy, or the reverse of that, what public radio stations to support, that can make a huge difference,
right?
People are thinking in the framework, in the attitude of the food companies, which after all are just companies doing what companies do, which is wanting to make as much money. They will be glad to make money selling truly healthful products if only they got the encouragement and more encouragement from people to do that. So fat. You know, fat was actually one of my favorite parts of the research for the book, because in so many ways it's more powerful than even salt and sugar. You know, we don't actually taste fat, scientists are still believing. It's not one of the basic tastes like sugar and bitter and
right.
Saltiness. Rather, thanks to this thing called the trigeminal nerve, which comes down nearly to the roof of her mouth, fat creates a sensation that gets picked up by the brain. It goes right to the pleasure center of the brain, just like salt and sugar, and says, wow, love that, eat more. Fat is that sensation of biting into a warm, gooey, toasted cheese sandwich. You can tell I'm sort of a fat and salt guy myself.
I love grilled cheese sandwiches.
Saying that, my brain is going, wow, you know, when will people buy those, make those pledges so I can go, like, eat some potato chips? Get me off this phone. You know, and the industry has learned and worked with fat, so it became one of their most powerful additives. They call that sensation the mouthfeel of fat. Fat has twice the calories of sugar, but your brain is much less apt to detect it in food, especially when it's solid fat, which also happens to be the type of fat that's associated with heart disease, saturated fat. So ironically, we're much more apt to recognize fat in a product when it's oily, which typically will be saturated fat as opposed to hidden in there as fat. And I write, you know, I spent a lot of time writing about the growth of cheese.
Cheese, that's a great part of the story.
You know, which basically is just, you know, a conveyance for fat. It is hugely loaded with saturated fat. Our consumption of cheese has tripled since the 70s, so to where we're now eating, on average per person, 33 pounds of cheese a year. 33 pounds. And I write about sort of how that happened, where the Department of Agriculture, in cahoots with the dairy industry, found a way to get us to eat more cheese, which was turning it into an additive. So now when you walk into the dairy aisle of the supermarket, and this is one of the things you want to know about as a consumer, it's loaded with packages of cheese that have been sliced, diced, shredded, stringed, tubbed, all to get us to put more cheese in our cooking at home. And then you walk through the store, and things like frozen pizza used to have a little cheese on the top.
Right.
Now it's got four or five cheeses on top and two more stuffed into the crust to maximize the allure, which also delivers those calories. Cheese is now the number one source of saturated fat in our diet.
So, and the in the few minutes we have left, two or three minutes here, just very quickly, a quick synopsis of James Lewis Kraft's first discoveries in cheese and how the decline in our dairy sales industry kind of pushed the sale of cheese.
Yes, so ironically, back in the 60s, people started drinking less whole milk as a way of avoiding saturated fat and calories. That left the dairy industry the problem because cows don't make low-fat milk, which is what people wanted to drink, and non-fat milk. So they had to make those things, they had to extract something called milk fat. Rather than throw that away, they started making more butter, more ice cream, and more cheese. They made so much cheese that the federal government started buying it because we have for decades wanted to support the dairy industry. None other than Ronald Reagan comes into office, discovers that there are caves filled with cheese going moldy that the federal government has bought because the dairy farmers are making so much cheese nobody can possibly eat it. They put their foot down. They say, no more buying of this cheese, but they create this scheme whereby the dairy farmers are allowed to tax themselves to create a marketing plan, and it's that marketing program using Madison Avenue that has gotten us to convert to eating cheese as an additive, something we don't even pay attention to in food, and it's there. And that's what drove the consumption of cheese.
Michael Moss, it's always a pleasure to have you on. I really appreciate you coming here doing the Fun Drive and helping us out so much. And you're just entertaining. You can go have your potato chips now.
Thank you so much, and so good luck with the rest of those six calls. I wish you the best.
Thank you so much, Michael Moss.
Bye.
Pulitzer Prize winning New York Times writer, the book Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. We'll be right back to talk about what you should be addicted to and what you are addicted to and hooked on, which is WEAA.